This is the Living Legacy Project interview with Rich Kegler on September 3rd, 2013. Rich, thank you so much for coming in today and consenting to join us for this interview.
Happy to be here.
You mentioned in our conversations prior to leading up to this that you don't consider yourself an artist, but could you talk a little bit about what inspired you to want to pursue a creative career and maybe even touch on what you think some of the distinctions between an artist and a creative type might be?
I guess it's just a problem with the definition. So even the word creative, when I hear the word creative, sometimes it kind of makes my skin crawl because I've set up at art fairs, such as the Allentown Art Festival, and one of the comments you hear all the time, oh, isn't that creative? It's sort of a condescending term for being clever or, you know, something you might say to a three-year-old when they, you know, draw a tree. And isn't that creative? So I guess the term, I think, needs to be better terminology all around. And in terms of what an artist is, I think it's up to a viewer or, you know, somebody can make things. And that kind of comes back to what I like to make things. That's what I do. I make things. And somebody can make things and not necessarily be an artist. Somebody could be a construction worker and be an artist, but not actually be aware of it. Mm-hmm. So I guess it just comes down to terminology.
I like to call that the distinction between, like, capital A artist and lowercase a artist, right?
That helps a little bit, but yeah, it gets even deeper than that, I think, though. So if somebody wants to say you're an artist, I'll say, well, I would consider it a compliment. I think it's probably meant to be that way, but I don't have that printed on a business card.
What do you have printed on your business card?
Actually, my latest card is nothing but my email address and no other text, and has a picture of a printer on it. So I'll go with printer.
Nice. Wonderful. Can you talk a little bit about what you do as a printer and sort of where you find you're currently at with your printmaking?
Good question. In terms of printing, it's really ramped up, I'd say, because of starting the Western New York Book Arts Center, which came about as a perceived void in, I call it, the cultural landscape of Western New York, and always having an interest in printing. And again, the term printing, you use the term printmaking, which again is a very specific word, versus just printer. I could make business cards for somebody and still be a printer. Mm-hmm. So I like Benjamin Franklin on his gravestone. It says one thing, printer, even though he's known for a lot of things. So it's having difficulty nailing down one thing. So in terms of printing or even printmaking, most of what I've been doing probably in the last 20 years has to do with letter forms. And P22 Type Foundry is the business that was founded about 19 years ago. And because of the historical background to most of the work we release as digital fonts, I've gone through a lot of research and kind of digging deeper into printing history, art history, design history, and having an interest in not just looking at the letters and making digital versions of them, but actually interacting with them and actually printing with old metal type and old wood type and things like that, and even printing blocks and to a point of carving wood as relief printmaking as well.
I think it's quite fascinating the way something can become too institutionalized, so that the terminology is then so rigid.
I just don't think there's enough terminology to really define what things are that we do or people anyone does. So.
Yeah.
But we'll get back to that, I guess.
Awesome. Can you tell us a little bit about where you went to school, if you went to school, and what that process was like?
I went to school. You mean college?
I do mean, I kind of leave it vague because some people then tell me about their high school experiences and other people talk about college.
Ultimately, I think everything going back to kindergarten probably has some influence in why people do things. Where do you think what would be good to start with?
Tell us about your college experience.
Yeah, since we're sitting here at Buff State and I'm looking over there and I realized, and it's really kind of bothering me because it was 30 years ago this week that I started at Buff State. And that's really disturbing to me that it's been 30 years and I still live nearby. Is this recording?
It is recording.
Oh, okay. Sort of Buff State is kind of an aimless undergrad with focusing on Upton Hall and the various art and design departments that didn't interact with each other in any way. And in fact, there's open animosity between the departments, but I was interested in both. And so I kind of went between one and the other, and I sort of approached art classes sort of like a design student would, and approached design classes the way an art student would. And so, you know, definitely made me a bit of an outcast in both, but so I ended up with a BS in art. It's a true fact. Bachelor of Science in Art.
Mm-hmm.
The BFA I considered, but I wanted to go on an exchange program, and the BFA at the time would have been just too rigid to allow for me to, and one way or another I was going to go, so I just stuck with the BS.
Mm-hmm. Where did you end up going and doing an exchange in?
Manchester Polytechnic.
Okay.
Manchester, England.
And what were you studying then?
I studied, I think it was, something like 17 credit hours of photography.
Oh.
I just, because of the way they have the program set up, you're just in the program. You know, it's not a a la carte thing. Mm-hmm. You basically, if you're majoring or that's your course of study, you just take it with all of your other classmates, the same classes.
Mm-hmm.
So it was strictly photography.
And at that point, did you have an interest in printing and fonts? And
No. I had an interest in art and design, and I thought photography, but the airline actually lost every bit of evidence that I was a photography student. Best notebook I've ever kept before or since. And, it's all gone.
No.
So I took that. I don't believe in fate or signs from above, but that seemed like a pretty good, maybe I should. Starting over would be tricky. So, yeah, I didn't really pursue photography after that.
Wow, the era before digital backups.
Yeah. Yeah, so, anyway.
Yeah.
I have memories.
When did your interest in font design and printing develop?
And printing was Buff State. It was largely through classes with Frank Ekmar, relief printmaking. And he had some wood type and metal type in there that students generally couldn't use or were discouraged from touching. And I never really used the type in there until actually after graduating and just asking for a favor that I could use the studio and print a poster. And but before that, it was all woodcut, basically, hand inking. And it wasn't really until after grad school that literally I kind of dove into the world of type design and type history research. And grad school had almost nothing to do with that. So it was basically my final project was in the Department of Media Study. It was the MAH program. So just the way I couldn't settle on one thing at Buff State, I couldn't settle on one thing at UB. And mostly because neither school really had what I really wanted. And for various reasons, didn't really look beyond the area much. That said, the media study department I was really interested in, but they didn't have a master's program, so I had to take a companion course of study, basically. So I went through the visual studies department and kind of bounced back and forth between the two, but I'd say primarily I was in the media study department. And my final project was an installation based on various ideas and artworks of Marcel Duchamp. So it was executing a series of projects using mostly computer technology and executing his ideas that couldn't really have used the computer to do that. So sort of randomizing a lot of things that he worked on, and John Cage eventually picked up on, the two of them being friends, and the chance operations and things like that. And the computer makes a lot of those things, facilitates a lot of those things. And actually, the biggest thing was probably a 3D animation of the large glass. So I had to build 3D models of the large glass in Philadelphia, the sort of Duchamp's.
Can you tell us a little bit about it?
About the large glass, or about it's a rather complex piece that ties into other works of Duchamp, but it's in the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and it's a large glass, basically two planes that depict its full name is The Bride Strip Air by Her Bachelor's Even. So there's actually two machines, the bride machine and the bachelor machine, and it's all condensed into a two-dimensional plane. But there, it's clearly intended to be three-dimensional objects, and of course it's famously broke, and claimed it improved it, or it's perfect. And again, that's just the Duchampian way of just accepting or finding things the way they are. So building 3D models, again, it seemed like through just looking at it or through sketches, or could build the models, and through descriptions that he wrote of how the machine, because obviously it's a stationary thing, so using his descriptions, we're actually able to sort of animate it, and using Amiga computers, state-of-the-art Amigas, and so there's a bit of an animation that went along with it, and that was projected onto a large screen. And there were several other components, but one component was a room full of quotes, because Duchamp's quotes were often hilarious, insightful, entertaining, contradictory. So I thought it would be good to actually have his quotes either projected, both projected, and printed out and put up on the walls. And it seemed like a typeface would be really, that looked like maybe he wrote it would be good, but nothing existed. So it was sort of, I guess the gauntlet was thrown down to come up with a font.
So you designed that font?
I worked with another person on it, and we came up with this font, this Duchamp handwriting font, that was only meant to be used for this one project. And then a few months after graduating and not really having jobs prospects, I kind of offered it up for sale and had some pretty major interest in it. And so we started packaging fonts and designing more, and it kind of snowballed. So the first couple of years were really good little business there, and it's been pretty respectable ever since.
Is that, when did P22 develop?
It was named P22. P22 was actually the name, a name applied to things before the Type Foundry. So there was a P22 snow sculpting team that entered in the local snow sculpting competitions. And one year we went to the national finals. And the P22 snow sculpting team, again, was sort of... It was fun with it. I could go into a couple stories about the nationals, but it's...
Well, what sort of things did you sculpt? Did you sculpt fonts and typefaces?
No, nothing at all. No, P22 had nothing to do with type. It has nothing to do with type. Uh-huh. The name, up until a couple of years ago, I had no idea. I found the name on a rubber stamp, but I had no idea what it meant. I've only a couple of years ago found out the origin of the P22. If you Google P22, you'll come up with fonts, but you'll come up with handguns. It's a very popular handgun called the P22. Just, yeah.
Oh, that's liminal.
Yeah, the Susan Komen Foundation has a pink one for breast cancer awareness.
Oh, that's the model.
Yeah, okay, see, it all comes full circle somehow. So the name was not meant to mean anything in particular, and so actually I printed up, yes, Dada is very influential. If I had to distill it down, I would say before there was a Type Foundry, anything that was P22 was just assigned to any project that was sort of a creative project, but also meant to be anonymous. So I had actually bought a printing press before grad school, and printed up letterpress postcards that had P22 International Industries, and it was kind of a fictional multinational corporation, and again, naming the type foundry, I didn't expect it to really be much of anything more than a blip, but that became sort of the business, and so everybody asked, what does P22 mean? And it's, I like the fact that you couldn't pin it down to something specific, and it sort of left it open to imagination, I guess, but... So some people it means handguns, some people it means fonts, and
some people it means snow sculpting.
Very few, but yeah, sure.
But they're out there. What are some of the other fun kind of anonymous projects, creative projects that you did early on?
Probably a mail art project. Yeah. That was the P22 mail art project. So the rubber stamp was used a lot on the mail art. There was a little bit of documentation online. The website hasn't been updated in, I'm almost proud of this, close to 18 years or so. It's the same HTML, and it's just small images. But some of the descriptions actually inspired other male artists. Basically, my friend Dan Farrell, who's also a local artist, he lived in Albany for a while. So I was making hand-bound books, and he was doing sculpture using found objects and found materials. And we would mail things back and forth to each other. And we just kept trying to outdo each other to see who could get something through the post office. We mailed pieces of concrete, shoes, paper cast of human heads, quite a bit. And there's actually a big archive of this material. But one that sort of took off and got a life of its own after us was called a sort of camera mail. We basically took a disposable camera with instructions mounted onto a board and with instructions for the postal workers to take pictures of each other in their day-to-day. And the postal workers were cooperative and actually did take pictures of each other. Surprisingly, a lot of them didn't actually charge the flash, which was kind of disappointing. I thought there were bright people that worked there. But anyway, so there is someone who started up a camera mail movement, and they credit us with being sort of the inspiration for that. So that was nice getting acknowledged.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
About what year or what?
Late 90s.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's hundreds of pieces that were mailed. Most infamously, one of the last pieces was hand delivered to me by the postal bomb inspector. He didn't have a good sense of humor about the whole thing. So it looked suspicious, let's say.
Is that before or after 9/11?
That was before. If it were after, I think it would have been a little more serious.
Has that project changed?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. The postal regulations are just so strict now, whereas before, you know, it would mail something that was basically the size of a postage stamp. It made a postcard that was the size of the stamp, so one side was the stamp and the other side was the address, and it got delivered. Or something that was a box with a see-through lid, and the stamps are on the inside. So the post office, who isn't supposed to open your mail, had to open the mail in order to cancel the mail. So sort of try to create dilemmas for them. And there are spinning wheels that, depending on where it landed when it went in, it might end up at a different address or another country. It was a pretty great project. And for a couple bored, underemployed artists, it was pretty great.
That sounds so awesome. And also, like, something I'm imagining being, like, the post office worker, right? Like, that would liven up my day.
Well, West Side Station right up the road, they would, after a while, they would have the objects waiting on the counter for me because I had everything sent to a P.O. box. And I still have the P.O. box. But, yeah, the workers who worked there, we thought about having a show there. It didn't actually happen. I really wanted to have an art show there. We ended up doing a show at Squeaky Wheel when they were on Elmwood, and we invited people to send new mail art in, and mail art still happens. I just contributed to a show that was in Cyprus, and it's now in Greece, but it's a group who's doing fairly active mail art, so it was kind of nice to dust off the box of I'd like to say I have one box of junk, but I basically have rooms full of junk. So basically kind of reconstruct the same type of mail art that
That's
we used to
fantastic.
Send. So that was fun.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you for talking to about that. That's really fascinating. I'd love to hear more about the archive at some point.
Yeah, there's like I said, there's the thoroughly outdated website. Yeah. I'd like to redo one, but wouldn't everybody like to redo a website? Yeah. You know,
have you thought of, have you submitted that website to the Internet Archive?
You mean like archive.org?
Yeah.
Well, that was automatic. I mean, I don't know.
You do some of it automatically, but some of it, like, just in case it hasn't been.
Yeah, I mean, if you go back, because it's so old, you can go back to, you know, pretty much all of the 2000s.
Yeah.
The aughts, the aughties.
Yeah.
So most of the aughts. So yeah, it's still there, but the others, it's we're redoing the P22 website, so that's, I'm going to have to come up with some other archive site, so maybe a Tumblr site would be a good excuse to redo it. And get some new photos, because there's literally hundreds of them, and some of them are, if I go back to them, I realize they're pretty good.
You may never like it again.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So you talked a little bit about type fonts and weird art, non-art projects. But can you talk a little bit about your relationship with hand-bound books and maybe how you started becoming interested in that?
Again, that I think all these threads that start tying together, the mail art was basically a byproduct of the hand-bound book. So I would make a mail art piece that maybe had, scraps of leather or marbled paper and sort of wrapping a board the same way the book cover would be wrapped, but partially onto a thing that would be mailed. So the bookbinding was, I learned from, again, Buff State, in the art department, papermaking specifically. They had a bookbinder named Bela Iro. He was in his 80s, and, you know, I was in my 20s and thought, watch this guy come in, and like, it was explained that he raised his family and mid to late 20th century entirely by hand binding books, which I thought was amazing that somebody could do this. And being fully aware of the Roycroft and the whole arts and crafts and the idea of, you know, making things with my hands, it was really appealing. I thought that would be really great to do something like that. So I learned some simple book structures in my design classes. My first design teacher, Lynn McElhaney, also used book structures as a way of teaching design principles, which was really, really great. And I took another class with her that was strictly on book design. And I only took that class because of a bureaucratic snafu that caused me to lose my enrollment in Buff State as a full-time student, which made me lose all my financial aid, so I had to scramble to get a class. I wanted to take a video class in media study while I was an undergrad here, and I did that, and I had to be a full-time student here. So I took the class, I registered for the class at UB. 5 weeks into it, I find out that because I dropped a class at Buff State, I was no longer full-time at Buff State. I thought, since with combined, I was a full-time student. They said, no, you're not full-time at Buff State. Therefore, you lose your full-time status. You lose your financial aid. You also cannot cross-register. So the video class was just pulled out from under me. But I had to scramble to get back to full-time status because it was a big mess. And the only teacher I could find who would give me a grade before I took the class was Lynn. And it was a book design class. So, again, I don't really believe in fate, but definitely these paths that you sort of take, that helped kind of guide me into doing book design. So when I finished undergrad, I occasionally made books and made them for gifts, and I took pictures of them, and I had slides, so I sent them into the Alan Turnout Festival, and I got in, and, you know, set up a little folding table with no tent, and I had some handmade books, and they were pretty badly made. Just, you know, I wasn't deep into, you know, learning the right way of doing things. I just thought, oh, these look cool, but they weren't structurally all that sound. So I kind of went back and started making more books, did another year at Allentown, which made me realize I never, ever, ever want to do this for a living. It's a nightmare, setting up a table and going to art fairs. And, you know, there's people who can do that, and it's you know, it can be a respectable way of doing things, but it definitely wasn't for me. And luckily I found someone who was interested in what I was doing, a woman named Lita Stathakis, who helped set up the Albright gift shop. I think she helped set up the Birchfield gift shop years ago. And she represented Artist Products. And so she liked the books. They were traditional hardbound books that included found objects, lots of scraps of paper, collages were built into the cover. There were no two that were alike. So these were all one of a kind. Absolutely, there's no mass production in these. And I used any kind of materials that I could fit into, you know, an eighth of an inch thick book board. And in the insides, it would be just writing paper mixed with decorative rice papers, mixed with all kinds of things. So they were kind of unusual books. And they were sold through gallery gift shops, high-end stationery, and museum gift shops. So I always tell people, yes, I had work in the Guggenheim. And then it's a gift shop very quietly afterwards. But I did have them in some pretty nice, pretty well-known museums. So for years, I would go with Lita to the New York International Gift Show at the Javits Center. And I basically would be her assistant. I'd help her carry some boxes, help set up. I would appear for a couple of the days to maybe talk to people who wanted to meet the artist. And it was a great little thing. And then after grad school, this was all simultaneous with grad school, I was doing this kind of stuff, decided to offer the Duchamp Fund. And that was, again, a last-minute idea, and really kind of thrown together literally at the last minute, and having no idea how it would be packaged, just sort of printed out a little 8.5 by 11 laser printed sheet, and that show had more orders for fonts than these handmade books. So really, that was like pivotal right there. I just decided, okay, I'm retiring as a bookbinder, and I did, essentially, yeah. But up until that point, I had made thousands of these books. And, you know, each one, doesn't matter how quick I got in binding, there still was no practical way to really make a living doing it the way I would have liked to have done it and charge the prices I would have liked. There's just this balance that you have to, you know, it's called reality. So I wanted anybody to be able to afford these, but I couldn't do that and make a living. So it seemed like, yeah, maybe a good time to switch gears. So that was how the business, sort of my, if I would have called it my job, switched from being a bookbinder to a type maker.
So very much within, you're still working within the same field.
Well, they're related. And I think it comes back to what I kept thinking, like, what is it I really want to be doing? And that, again, goes back to Frank Ekmark's class. I think he showed the class a book by, I think it was Leonard Baskin, wood engraver, who it was like a fine press edition of Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven. I didn't know what fine press was. Basically, you know, the subject matter was basically public domain. That doesn't define public, that doesn't define fine press, but it definitely, you know, helps when somebody wants to print a book and they don't have a writer to collaborate with. There is, you know, a great history of work that can be pulled from.
Can you define fine press?
Expensive books. Good. But more than expensive. They're expensive in some ways. They're fine books made with great attention to the paper, to the typeface, to the illustrations, to the binding, to the thread used in the binding, to the color of the thread used in the headband of the binding, to the glue that's the right kind of, you know, every detail is attended to. It's even a company like Random House or Penguin, they might not care about grain direction. They basically figure out which way the paper goes to fit the most sheets on, whereas grain direct, you know, all these things in fine press kind of comes back to the Roycroft. The Roycroft, fine press people will often say Roycroft was a bunch of crap. And a lot of what the Roycroft produced was a bunch of crap. And it's basically, Albert Hubbard was an amazing businessman. And he found, it was a vanity press for him. The fine press end of it, it was basically his wanting to emulate William Morris. William Morris made the Kelmscott books, which again, our Kelmscott is fine press. All the people who imitated the Kelmscott want to be fine press. The Roycroft took it in a slightly different direction. The Roycroft did produce fine press editions, very limited editions of a book, but they would also produce a mass edition of that same title so that everybody could afford them. So you could buy a book for 10 cents or you could buy a book for $20, which in 1896 dollars, is Googleable, but it's a lot of money. So in a way, what William Morris wanted to do, William Morris was an ardent socialist. However, he produced these books and these works that no one could afford but the ultra-rich. Hubbard somehow managed to emulate Morris, but make the stuff accessible to the masses, and sort of, he was interested in getting, literature, public domain, or mostly his own writing, I think. He was a pretty funny guy, but he was also, I could say a lot of good things about Hubbard, and I can say a lot of bad things about Hubbard, and I try to balance it, because I think both are equally valid. And I think he does have a bad reputation in the fine press world. So back to what you were saying, what is fine press? Mm-hmm. Kelmscott Press is probably the pinnacle of fine press. Handmade paper, very few people use handmade paper. Buff State did a paper making program. So I realized doing all of these things I could do, or potentially could do. And then the only slightly more modern person that I could really zero in on and I look at as one of my influences is actually Dart Hunter. He worked at the Roycroft for a couple of years, and later in life he kind of dismissed it, but he was really prolific when he was at the Roycroft, and his graphic identity, his graphic style really still defines what the Roycroft is on so many levels. I mean, if you take away what Hunter designed and did for the Roycroft, there's not a whole lot left. The most distinct work was Hunter's work, and the people who then copied Hunter at mm-hmm. the Roycroft after he left. So it was he sort of established their house style, if you want to call it that. But he was, Hunter did the same thing. He made fine press books. They're mostly books about paper making, but he made the paper. Initially, he designed a typeface. Later on, his son designed a typeface. He wrote the book. He did the illustration. So it's basically something they call a one-man book or something. He didn't do the bookbinding. That was maybe the one thing he didn't do. And so I thought, as a bookbinder, if I could call myself that, that would be something I want to eventually do. And I've done a couple small book editions and a couple things that I guess I'm never satisfied. Some people say, oh, you're grumpy. And I'm like, can't you be satisfied? I'm like, no, I can't be satisfied because I still feel, that's what gets me up in the morning and makes me want to do things is that, no, I haven't achieved what I want to, even though I don't know what I want to achieve.
I think it's important to always have something to strive for.
Yeah, of course.
Because once you're satisfied with what you're doing, you're not trying as hard anymore.
Mm-hmm. So fine press books, the book as sort of an all-in-one, this nice little concise multi-discipline book. A book is truly multimedia. I mean, again, what I mentioned, type design, paper making, printmaking, book binding, color theory, harmony, Fibonacci sequence is really nice for the golden mean for payout page layout. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a good way to establish your borders. It works. It works for snails. It works for Nautilus shells and Da Vinci codes and all kinds of things.
And some element of chemistry as well.
Yeah, I mean, I ideally, my vision of, the perfect book, I want to make the ink. And that's related to what I want my ashes disposed of when I'm done, but we can keep that out of this for now. So, yeah, there's chemistry involved. There's math. I mean, printing involves a fair amount of math and... So coming back to what a fine press book is, usually it's a one-person press, and they have a vision of what they want to do. And there's hundreds of them out there. There's small press, usually small press poetry. It's more about the poetry, and as opposed to the final piece could be a you know, I was going to say mimeograph or Xerox. I would say laser print. Could be how it's produced, but I think the full package of where every piece is really carefully considered and crafted by person or group of people. And yeah, that's what I would hope to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the idea of a book being an edition as well. I mean, mm-hmm. a book could be a one of a kind, the Book of Kells. There's one of them. Every page, you know, no one could look at more than one page. You know, I think it's probably all photographed, but you know, you get the idea.
Yeah, that's phenomenal. Yeah. I both want to talk to you about, you know, you've touched on some of your influences, so
mm-hmm.
I feel like we should continue on in that vein. But I also want to talk to you about how all of these different desires of yours have sort of grown or found some outlet through Winnie Back and all
mm-hmm.
sorts of that. But let's start with some of your influences in the various types of work that you've done.
Okay. Well, I mean, I think we've touched on a bunch of them. Dart Hunter, definitely.
Yeah.
Duchamp, definitely. I would say sort of, I mean, everybody throws Duchamp around. But
you mean it.
Yeah, but I mean it. Yeah, I did a thesis project on it, so there. I think Duchamp's humor, and I think with a lot of artists, I think the humor has, again, too serious. Unless you're really solving world problems, don't take yourself too seriously, you know. But another artist, I would, again, most people don't know who he is, but W.A. Dwiggins, he was a book designer and type designer, and he's fairly well known in the puppet world, which always surprises people. In the Boston Public Library, there's a Dwiggins room, and it basically has marionettes that he made. The marionettes in the movie Being John Malkovich were directly based on his puppets, and he sort of innovated. He innovated puppet design in a way where he developed how they're carved, in that they're very, very sharp features, so that when you see them far away, they get softened up. Like if you did a realistic puppet and you had a doll, say, and you had it far away, it would just get fuzzy. But a puppet on a stage with very deep-set eyes and very sharp cheekbones, the lighting would, you'd basically see it very clearly from far away. He used those exact same principles in justifying his type designs, that you saw at very small sizes. So if you saw them really big, they kind of look grotesque and weird, but at small sizes, though, you'd be very readable. So he sort of combined disciplines in a way that I don't think anybody really expects. But again, he had a really great sense of humor, and you know, if I could be somebody, you know, he would be on that list. Definitely family influences. Most of my siblings are involved in art and design, and my grandfather, that I never actually knew, always made things. He was a machine tool and die worker, and he made objects that are sort of scattered around, you know, various siblings' houses, but he just made cool things. I mean, we kind of grew up always seeing these things and just like, wow, he made this, and like fashioned out of metal. It's not something, you know, you pick up, you know, it's not like a kit. It's just like the fact that these things were really made by, and you realize everything is generally made by a person or a machine, and when it's made by a person, it just has a, you know, totally different feeling, approach. So, you know, again, I'm sure there's a lot of influence there through having, again, brothers who are in the arts in various capacities, and mostly graphic arts, design, fine art. So that helps.
Mm-hmm.
I think think you've already got Tom and Kevin, I think, have works in the Birch Field.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely others. You know, just mention John Cage. I'm not a musician. I like playing music. I definitely like listening to music, and actually had a record shop for 4 years while I was doing undergrad at Buff State. I thought it would be a good idea to open a record shop. Wasn't a good idea.
While doing undergrad?
Yeah. Yeah. So overcommitting is one thing that I'm trying to learn not to do. Like starting up a nonprofit.
Yes.
While you still have a full-time business to run. Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about Winnieback or the Western New York Book Arts Collaborative.
Well, again, that came back to interest in bookbinding, interest in the Roycroft, interest in the history of Buffalo history, and Buffalo having, at one time, again, I haven't found real facts to back this up, but I've heard a couple places that Buffalo had more printers per capita than in any city in the U.S., and where the Book Art Center is now, Washington Street actually was sort of a printer's row, and there were a lot of printers, and actually American Type Founders had a Buffalo office right on Washington Street. And the idea of starting it up was, part of it was, after I graduated here, I wanted to make books, and I needed to have access to things like paper cutters, and I wanted to make handmade paper. After a little bit of time, it became increasingly difficult as a Buff State alumnus to set foot into a building to be able to do things if I was not a registered student. You hear that, Buff State? it's not unique to Buff State. It's unique to a lot of people who basically, okay, you're graduated, you're out in the world, you're out of the nest, go. However, if you're using very specialized equipment, you can't really have access. So I discovered that there was the Center for Book Arts in New York, the Minnesota Center for the Book in Minneapolis was probably the real sort of one of those real key moments in visiting the space, and realize in a sort of rundown part of Minneapolis, they basically retrofitted some old buildings that were sort of tenement buildings, and they had within a space called Open Book, they had a literary center, they had a book art center, they had a coffee shop, they had a used bookshop, all book related, writing related, nonprofit incubator space. I thought, well, that's kind of cool. So realizing that with all the arts organizations in Buffalo, Birchfield has a large craft art, although it's not called, they don't call it craft art anymore, do they? I think they give it a different name.
No, we still
have. Oh, okay.
It depends.
I think the show is called something like Art and Craft Media as opposed to craft art.
Right.
Again, it comes down to definitions and terminology. But realizing there wasn't something in Buffalo where I basically try to cajole printers and say, can I come in and use your paper cutter? I've got a big stack of bookboard I need to cut. Like, you're not cutting that stuff on our paper cutters. That stuff's nasty. And it is. It'll dull the blade. So, but if you try cutting this stuff with an X-Acto knife, it will take you days to cut an imprecise stack of papers, whereas if you have the right machine, ka-chunk, it's done. So I would try to talk to printers, and I met, I never actually knew him, but people told me about this guy, Hale Leader, down at a place called Printing Prep in Tupper Street in Buffalo. Turns out Hale had a little room in his business. Printing Prep was a typesetting house, and they went back years, and they kind of just kept adapting with the new technology. So while the Macintosh essentially put commercial typesetters out of business, they remained doing services that you couldn't just do on your desktop computer. But Hale had a room called Paradise Press, and it was a stained glass door, and you open it up, and in there is a giant picture of William Morris and a giant picture of Emil Celine, who was Hale's mentor. And Emil was one of the last Roycroft printers, so Hale was trained, sort of this guy was Hale's mentor, and Emil worked there until basically the day he died, and it's sort of a little museum of a room that's to this day still inside Printing Prep. And after meeting Hale, I thought, when I retire, I don't know what's going to happen to all this stuff. And I said, well, I have this idea. And so the idea of the Book Arts Center, talked about it a bit more, talked with a few different people and started having events. The first official Winnieback workshop was actually at the Roycroft, because it was the same time the Roycroft Corporation, Roycroft Campus Corporation, was kind of re-energizing what was going on in East Aurora. So we thought, you know, this collaboration between organizations, and that was the way we wanted to approach Winnipeg, was that it was the Western New York Book Arts Collaborative. Until we had the building, then we tried to switch the name for common use to Western New York Book Arts Center, because now we have a center. So the idea was to work with other cultural institutions and kind of fill a void that other arts and cultural organizations maybe didn't. So equipment access, press access, as a lot of printmakers know, you may be trained as an intaglio printer, but unless you have your own press, it's really hard to do that on your kitchen table. So again, these are things that kind of resonated, because there's a large, Buffalo has a lot of college graduates, a lot of arts graduates, and there's not a lot of jobs. Mm-hmm. But the desire to make things and make artwork is there. Certain types of artwork, you don't need specialized equipment. Other, with the book arts and with all that entails, there's a lot of specialized equipment. And so the idea that you could go to a place and buy tools and supplies, or also sell your work, display your work. So that was the drive, was sort of this void in my own experience in doing bookbinding and finding that I couldn't get easy access to things that you kind of could in other cities. So I figured, I'm going to live here, made the decision to stay here, and I try to kind of call it give back. But yeah, that was kind of the idea.
Awesome. And so what year would you say the collaborative started, and what year did you get your own space at the center?
2005, I'd say, was probably really when the organization really gelled as an organ. You know, we started doing events, bringing in guest speakers to like the Karpeles Manuscript Museum. Mm-hmm. And then 2008 was the building was acquired. My wife and I basically, we sold a building that P22 was in, moved the business into our house, sort of had an extension loft built into our house. And with the money we made on the building, we put it all into this building downtown. And it was basically literally giving back. I mean, it was rent-free for as long as we could possibly do it. And we put a lot of money into renovating the building and got it to a point where the second floor could be rented out, where the income goes to the Book Arts Center, which is the way it is right now. So just Buffalo Literary Center is on the second floor. And when it was a totally derelict second floor. So it's come a long way.
I've always wanted to ask you, I haven't been by to Winnipeg recently, but how did you guys get all those printing presses into the basement?
It's best not to think about it all at once, but one piece at a time, and with human stupidity
willpower.
And willpower and simple machines, mainly a ramp that was built onto the stairs and slid down the stairs, and getting them out be probably a little trickier. Gravity helped lower them in.
Yeah.
Gravity will make it harder to get them out if that ever has to happen.
Now, are these the pieces from the printing prep?
Actually, that's nothing is. All that equipment came from other shops. Mm-hmm. Some of it donated, a lot of it donations. Word got out that we were doing this, and there were people really interested in seeing what was going on. Meanwhile, Paradise Press is still intact. And Hale worked out, as he retired, he sold his business to his employees, so he still owns the building. So there was no get your stuff out of here kind of thing. That was part of the deal, is he gets to keep that room. So it's not used all that much by anyone. At least once a year, Hale will make a Christmas card, and he usually goes in and does it there. And someday, you know, there'll need to be some disposition of the material, but it's a really great collection, and it has a lot of history to it. If the Book Art Center can help preserve, that's you know, part of the mission, is there's a preservation component to this stuff and keeping it used as well. And you know,
when I first visited Winnipeg, maybe in 2008, I didn't know who you were at the time, but there was a rainy Saturday right after Winnipeg moved in, when you were putting up a wheat paste on the side of a building down the street.
Yeah.
And I came by to help with that.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Wow.
So, and that was the first time that I...
I still don't remember you specifically,
yeah,
but
I do
remember two people who came up and helped.
Yeah.
That I didn't know.
And we, I remember you as just a grumpy old man in the rain who...
That's about right.
Yeah. He's like, God damn it.
That's pretty great.
But after that, we stopped by and went down and saw the printing presses in the basement and everything. I don't remember if it was you or someone else, but someone really did talk about the preservation component of all this. And it's not just the preservation of the equipment, but of the techniques as well. Mm-hmm. And really keeping those techniques, which are increasingly... pushed to the side as we move into more technological capacity, relevant and capable and allowing people to learn from
exactly.
that joy.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it's not a, I mean, it's, if you want to call it a living museum, but the idea is the stuff that's there is not just to be looked at. Yeah. We want interpretational material so people understand it if no one's there to explain it to them. But using it is really important. There's Hatch Show Print in Nashville. They're actually... operated under the guise of the Country Music Hall of Fame, but it was a print shop that's been around for 150 years. And they use the phrase preservation... Oh, God, what was the term now? I forgot it. I mean, in Buffalo, the term's been used, preservation by neglect has been one of the terms used for Buffalo's architecture. But it's preservation by... preservation through use, basically. Mm-hmm. So you're preserving the materials by actually using the materials mm-hmm. and teaching people how to do... in theory, the right way to do things, because, again, you can kind of figure it out. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not, it's pretty simple when you come down to it. It's the subtleties that are, can get pretty complex and why there needs to be 6-year apprenticeships before anyone could actually print something. But this, there's this amazing history material. I mean, literally 500 years since Gutenberg, that technology really hadn't changed much until, you know, the 20th century, I should say, and as it becomes lost, it's, I mean, there's an interest in understanding it, and again, it's, there's something very, very different from a cheap laser print to a handmade paper with some nice little slight impression and some, you know, there's a big difference.
It's a massive difference.
So, yeah, there's a whole many. Talk about that for hours yeah. about why that's important, but I felt it's important. That's why, you know, as grumpy as I might be at times, that's sort of what drove me to keep doing this stuff. Yeah. That wheat pasting, by the way, that summer was like the wettest summer, and it started growing mold on it, and it was like, oh boy, let's just sort of walk away from it. But
don't make eye contact.
Yeah, we had permission from the building owners to do it, but I think they afterwards they were kind of like, oh, what happened here?
Yeah, and, well, it's not your fault that it was, but
right.
So I have one last question about Winning Back, and then I'd like to move on. Mm-hmm. But Winning Back has now been around for 8 years. It's been in its current location for, what, five?
Yeah.
And you have recently stepped away as the executive director.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you see Winning Back's next steps going forward as it...
I wish I knew.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit of a difficult time for the organization, mm-hmm. and it's a difficult time for me to sort of not be able to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm feeling a little bit helpless about it,
yeah.
but... I can't really jump in. I mean, it needs to find its way.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like a toddler that kind of like falls on its face. I'm like, I don't know if that's a good analogy. But it's definitely in a kind of a pivotal time right now. We try to set the pieces in place for various income streams. And, you know, mainly I want to see more community involvement, more people just who want to use it can get in there without feeling there's a barrier
mm-hmm.
or, you know, feeling like it's a club or something.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to be more accessible.
Mm-hmm.
And the more events that happen there, I think that can help. I mean, we've hosted Pecha Kuchas a couple of times and other events, and there's always people who are there for the first time, and they're just like, wow, what is this? it's kind of a special place.
It's an incredible space. And it needs, it's an incredible organization.
Oh, well, thanks. I feel good about it.
Yeah.
But it's not there yet. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the economy is not to anyone's liking after, again, 2008 is kind of a, that year means a lot because we started before the official tanking of the economy. So we definitely had a very rocky start, and it was, I would never say it was easy. I'd say that of anything I've ever done, the Book Art Center is probably the most difficult thing to, you know, kind of like a car that keeps stalling. But you know, you got to make everybody else think your car is just rolling down the street just fine, and even if your feet are the one pushing the car along.
But
so
really, it's the most exquisite car, you know, and it is.
Yeah, it's
just
kind of a wacky car, kind of a tricked out.
Well, now I'm imagining a printing press as a car.
Yeah,
that could
power it. Yeah, yeah.
So like a. I was actually just telling a friend who just started the art conservation program about Winnie Beck because she just moved to town. Like, you have to go check them out.
Yeah, that reminds me. Sorry, not for the interview, but they have their conservation has their evaluation thing coming up, don't they?
I think so.
I've got a piece that needs some work, but yeah. There's all these components that made the Book Arts Collaborative seem like a great idea. If the Roycroft, you have the history there and the desire for activity there. You have the Art Conservation Department, art graduates. Rochester has a lot as well, and therefore Western New York was meant to be beyond Buffalo. Yeah. And so physically, it's still not easy. The commute between Rochester and Buffalo always seems a lot longer than mm-hmm. it really is. Mm-hmm. It's just one of those barriers that's there.
Yeah.
But again, that and now, so the Book Arts Center is open. As a member, I'm very happy to be able to go in and use a press mm-hmm. and maybe work on a private press book that, you know, there's a few different ideas that I have. And yeah,
so
have to follow them through.
Moving into where you see yourself going forward now that you're sort of letting Winnie Beck sort of bruise its knees and get on its own mm-hmm. feet, and you're sort of maybe more thinking about your own work again. Where are you at, and where do you see yourself going forward?
That's a good question. I again, most time is spent with P22 as a business and working on both custom typefaces and called retail face. So we have a large catalog of fonts that we just sell online. And it's that world has expanded like most things. Like, you know, you could compare to the music industry, every 10 years there's that many more songs out there. So, you know, there's no way for everybody to know or hear everything that's out there. So fonts are kind of, there's hundreds of thousands of fonts out there. So people are overwhelmed by the, you know, 100 fonts that might be in a menu on a computer. Mm-hmm. So for a lot of people, they don't need to go out and buy fonts. So we try to make ourselves, you know, stand out in the marketplace. So much of it's about marketing. Ultimately, I'd like to just sit down and design type and not have other considerations, but there's you know, bottom line considerations. So yeah, we got to come out with some fonts that are kind of cool, and somebody is going to want to actually pay money for them.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, that's still for a little bit. But I, you know, ultimately when I have what I consider free time, then I can really focus on doing a book project that's really, you know, feel like it's a complete book project. We actually, one of the closest things we had to in doing that, we collaborated at the Book Art Center with Richard Tuttle, which was kind of a surprise.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, actually had a correspondence with him about this book project where it was basically co-designed, and we produced it at the Book Art Center mm-hmm. and printed it. And it's pretty, you know, that kind of got me excited again that, you know, wow, I don't know that I'll ever collaborate with Richard Tuttle again, maybe. That would be amazing.
Well,
but
people are paying attention even when you're not aware of it.
Yeah, and that, I think, got a lot of people's attention. I ran into somebody in Milwaukee not so long ago who said, "Oh yeah, I was at the Book Art Center in Buffalo," and there had this. I wasn't there for the reading by Richard Tuttle, but we zeroed in. That's what she was there for. She came in from New York to go to this reading, and again, it just sort of had this really great splash. And it was, in the end, it was just a very small little mm-hmm. book, but it was, you know, every detail of it, you know, it was really great to have mm-hmm. a hand in that.
Does Winnieback often publish small editions of?
Not as much. I mean, to me, that was one of the things I saw as a vision for the place, was to have a publishing program and to do things like that. So when the Tuttle Project came along, to me, in a way, this was exactly what one, well, not, there's no one thing, but this was definitely one of the things I wanted to see happen. So the idea that we could do, even if, you know, I see Dwayne Hatchett, to yeah. be able to like do a book with Dwayne Hatchett. And so you have this edition. Again, edition books make, again, the Tuttle book signed, I think, sold for about $300 or something, where his regular artwork would sell, you add a couple zeros. Mm-hmm. So a book, in a way, An artist book, which is different than fine press, but artist editions and artist collaborative books. You know, people can buy an artist book that actually has signed Robert Motherwell prints in it for much, 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 much less than a signed Motherwell print. It's kind of an interesting, it really, the book somehow makes the artwork that much more accessible to a wider number of people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that I find a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And there really isn't anything else like that happening in Buffalo, you know, for.
Again, that was the void that I saw I would like to see it maybe become a print studio where artist prints could be made, editioned there,
mm-hmm.
in, you know, where the artist is actually on premise, you know, as opposed to work for hire.
Yeah.
I mean, again, New York has plenty of print studios where an artist will go and have their print made,
mm-hmm.
and they may do it themselves, or they may hire a master printer maker to do it. Buffalo really doesn't have that kind mm-hmm. of thing, which I think it could. So that's room for growth. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of room for growth. It's just, again, a lot of times it comes down to the money. Situation. So, you know, we do a lot of workshops for kids at the Book Art mm-hmm. Center. You know, future customers, some people like to say, but the response and the enthusiasm has been pretty amazing. But I think there's a wider scope of what could be done there, mm-hmm. and will be done there.
Mm-hmm. Especially with kids, though, I think it's really fascinating because, you know, children who are growing up today are growing up in a world where the computer has always existed,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so, and I'm even very close to that transition. You know, I remember when we first got our MS-DOS computer when I was about 8, but I think it's in the same way that I think kids need to have a relationship with the food they eat to
mm-hmm.
really understand the process of creation.
Yeah, that's an analogy I use all the time with the Book Art Center. It's like, you know, called letterpress is the slow food movement of printing, because again, you are really slowing down, interacting with every letter, as opposed to just boom, boom, typing it up. I mean, you can still have typos, hand setting, but you interact in a real, much more profound way. I mean, typesetters, even I found myself doing this. I was asked to typeset a poem for someone. And as I was typesetting it, I realized I changed it because I thought it should say something else. That's why you have proofreaders. But still, it really, you know, you're reading it one letter at a time, one word at a time, and it's not just here's your text, throw it on a page, print it out, and you're done. It's really a slow food, and you know, it's there's a lot of similarities.
Yeah, slow type.
Yeah. There was, do you know about the film that I did?
No.
Oh.
Tell us about the film that you did.
The film I did was actually, I would say, one of my inspirations, but I've only met him in maybe 2005-ish. A guy named Jim Rimmer from Vancouver.
Uh-huh.
BC. And he was a pretty unassuming graphic artist, although I like to point out his most famous work is probably he did the logo for the band Heart. But he basically, he made his own books, including the binding, including each typeface design, including illustrations. An amazing person. And we, P22, had essentially acquired his typeface collection. Again, there's a long, long story behind this. And in getting to know him, I just found him to be one of the most genuine, nicest people who basically did what he wanted and lived very, very modest means and just made really amazing things. And so we talked to him about, since he made his own metal typefaces for his books, said, would you be open to having a digital font and a metal font being, you know, I think he actually upped the bar. My suggestion was we digitize one of his metal fonts and make it available for sale, so somebody could buy either the metal version or the digital version. And you know, there's really two different eras. There's other technologies in between. And he said, well, I have this design I'm working on. How about if we release that? And it's like, wow, a brand new design. So that was the hook, was this is the first ever simultaneous metal and digital font release. And so I thought, this opportunity is just never going to present itself again. So I basically rented equipment from Squeaky Wheel. I hadn't actually used... My media study background is now about to come in handy. And I lived in his house for 8 days and shot lots of footage, hung out, and you know, got up with him at 5 a.m. to go to Starbucks, where everybody knew him, and there, you know, it was actually New Westminster, it wasn't mm-hmm. Vancouver proper. And then, you know, go for salmon, fish and chips and for dinner, and just hung out with him, and it was just amazing. And so in the end, I made this film that it's called Making Faces, which actually debuted at the Birchfield Penny Arts Center on March 10th, I believe, 2011.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. And I'm still showing the film. I'm actually going to England next month for 2 weeks to show the film in, I think, 6 different places.
That's wonderful. Well, congratulations.
Yeah, thanks. So it's gotten a lot of mileage. I mean, we've sold quite a few copies.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a fairly specialized film. It's filmed on his process of making a typeface. And this really was never documented before. So it's being seen as, you know, some people see it and say, I'm going to make it. He makes it look easy. He's mm-hmm. a very unassuming person, very likable person. And very sadly, he died shortly after the footage was shot. So it was the timing, the fact that it was filmed, who just was able to capture this. But I consider him one of my heroes. I mean, he did some great work.
Oh, no,
and he was such a good person. I mean, that was the key. I mean, I know I'm a grumpy person. He was not a grumpy person. He was just such a nice sweetheart. He was amazing.
That's fascinating, though. I'm so interested in this. You going to be...
I should have brought you a copy. I'll get you one.
I think we've touched on so much of this in a really nice...
Yeah, I think that's...
Anecdotal.
What did I say there?
What would help advance your artistic career? A big fat grant and financial independence.
Well, I think that's goes saying without for a lot of people.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, there's the bottom line. There's certain things you have to do in life. I've been really, really lucky in that I've kind of avoided working for other people. I've worked, you know, delivered pizzas. I've worked in bookshops. I've worked and washed dishes. My first job was washing dishes in a restaurant. And, you know, those kind of things make you realize, I can't keep doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And my goal was to sort of not work for anybody, but also not be anybody's boss.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't really have both. I think there's very seldom can you kind of hit that middle ground. So we have people working for us at P22, and I'm, you know, I don't really consider myself a prime boss material.
Mm-hmm.
And
how big is the staff?
Right now, it's there's five of us right now. We had at one time we had nine people, and it was mostly packaging because we actually packaged and shipped to museum gift shops, the same ones that bought the books. So there's still other threads that I haven't necessarily connected, but somehow all this stuff does connect.
Yeah.
And basically, those connections I had for buying the hand-bound books very easily adapted to becoming customers for the fonts.
Yeah. For the audio, I'm going to say the question again in a less reading it off the page way.
Okay.
So I'm just going to say, what would help advance your career in the arts or in, I guess you don't even consider it your career in the arts, yeah?
Well, I guess I'd like to have a career in the arts, yeah. But to do that, I think, again, having some level, financial comfort level,
yeah.
Whereas the bottom line isn't driving the artwork.
Yeah.
And I think that maybe that's, in a lot of ways, that is where there's this defining line. Because there is, you know, if you think about almost people, all due respect, I think a lot of people who set up at art fairs, it's basically there to make a living. And making your art is a great way to do it. But ultimately, is that the art you would be making if you didn't have to sell that art to make your living? What would you be doing? And I think there's very, very small, you know, obviously that's the goal, the pinnacle of the New York art world is just to be the it artist. And, you know, there's plenty of undesirable things you could do to make a living making art, even if it isn't the ideal thing. And so... yeah, I'd love to make really cool things and give them away. That would be really great. But I was also, if I can make cool things and have people buy them at a reasonable price and feel like they got a deal, you know, it's a tough thing. So yeah, I think financial independence. Everybody says, yeah, I want to live in the lottery, but you got to live within reality and just move on with what you have. And
yeah.
And so making stuff is something that I want to do.
Yeah. Thank you for answering that way. I do have one more question about
mm-hmm.
what you were saying about P22. You mentioned that you package fonts.
Mm-hmm.
But what does that actually mean?
Initially, it meant physically, and in the first couple of years, taking a floppy disk
mm-hmm.
and actually designing. I hated the idea that all software came in big boxes, and you buy this box, and you get a disk in it, and you
mm-hmm.
get, you know. So it basically came up with a very minimal packaging that just happened to be the same size as a 45 RPM record because I had all these sleeves left over from my record shop. And so, okay, I'll design them that size and basically put them in a little plastic sleeve and stuck it onto a cardboard flat. And the flats were either screen printed. We did a font with the Birchfield Penny's assistance, the Arts and Crafts font. And so that was actually letterpress printed with a floppy disk stuck on there. And so there are these packages that look like basically like a record, and they were physically packaged. Eventually it went to a 3/4 inch thick, but they're still 7 inches square, and they all sit on like a shelf, like a bookshelf in a shop. And Apple discontinued the floppy drive, so we switched to CDs. And so we would have CDs pressed up, and we'd have people take them and put them inside the packaging. And that's the packaging of the fonts, and fulfill mail order.
Yeah.
So everything from Book of the Month Club and a bunch of catalogs, so we'd ship out boxes and boxes of boxed fonts. So there's a lot of packaging. And we've pretty much done away with all the packaging.
Mm-hmm. But it's a nice relationship, too, thinking of your history with mail art. And now with,
yeah.
You know, it does sound like there is an artistic component to how you were.
Like I said, yeah, all this stuff kind of ties together in these weird threads. And, you know, yeah, I don't have a real profound wrap-up for that. But.
No, that's great. You know, it's so interesting. I have this question here that I always ask, and that is, do you want to take a second? Do you need to?
No, I'm actually just fidgeting.
Okay. Wait, how are you doing for time?
I'm fine.
We're close to done.
Yeah.
I have this question here that I normally ask, where I ask, what are some of your needs as an artist or creative type that the larger community can provide?
Hmm.
But I think that a big theme of like this whole interview has been seeing the gaps in the community.
Yeah, I guess I've realized that on its own, nobody's really going to fulfill those needs. So I felt, in a way, if I could fulfill it. And granted, there's a selfish aspect to it too. I want access to this stuff still. I'm going to be the most active member of the Book Arts Center if I can be that person. But seeing what I felt was missing and trying to find a way of fulfilling it, that's kind of, yeah. But again, so, you know, some kind of philanthropy to help run the Book Arts Center is probably what I would see as being the need to be filled. And beyond that, it could be related to other things, and there's exciting things happening, like at the Foundry out, because they, again, in a similar way, maybe a community welding, but like you want to weld something, you can't, sure, you could go out and buy all the equipment if you had the means, and then you need the space, but to have a community center like that, woodworking, all these sort of maker spaces, they're really exciting that they're happening. So happy to be a part of that on the printing level.
Yeah, and that's something actually I took a note on as well, which is the relationship or the distinctions between Winnieback and the Foundry and the way the Foundry is growing as a maker space.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of collaboration, if you see that there's a synergy there.
Yeah, I would think there should, could, and hopefully will be.
Mm-hmm.
I think the physical distance, the fact that they're not in the same building, makes it difficult. You mentioned moving the equipment into the Book Arts Center. There's a will, there's a way to move any. I've seen things move that I would never even dream of moving. So I don't feel like, so if there was another space that maybe an old Trico building that could become the Alta Buffalo's sort of central hub of makerspace, as you know, instead of little small pockets, you know, something like Buffalo Artist Studio, but sort of extrapolated into what the Foundry's doing, and sort of having an all-in-one sort of physical material. You know, again, it could be artist studios, could be any number of I was just thinking about the Kohler toilet factory and how it comes back to urinals. But actually, when the T22 snow sculpture team was in the Nationals in Milwaukee, Dan and I decided to skip out for a day, which was just totally scandalous. We went to the Kohler factory, because the Kohler Factory has an amazing artist-in-residence program where the workers will allow an artist to have free reign. So the people who put the porcelain coatings on giant bathtubs will basically say, yeah, you want to make something giant porcelain, and we'll help you do it. And so what Kohler was doing, I thought, was the most amazing thing, because here's a very industrial company who obviously supports the arts. The Kohler Arts Center is huge.
Yeah.
But the way they allowed access in an artist program, I thought that was like a dream thing to do. Never actually happened. We never applied to it. But that really was really
That's
inspirational.
Incredible.
And so getting back to the urinal, the whole idea was Karima, my wife, who started P22 with, we were asked to be on the Birchfield Committee for starting up the new building. Yeah, the alumni committee. So we were somehow, I think we were the 80s group, because we both finished up in the late 80s at Buff State. And they had a couple from each decade. And it was, basically cultivating to ask your friends to donate money. And I said from the beginning, look, none of my friends who graduated Buff State have any money. This is not going to happen. And I do not want to, I can't ask people for money. This is why I'm not a good executive director. I cannot ask people for money. So the time came to ask people for money. Sorry, Ted. In the end, they asked us for money. And so I thought, well, P22 could donate, but under conditions, because they're talking about naming benches and naming bricks and all these conventional ways. I said, I want naming rights for a urinal. And I think it was basically refused. And I don't know, I was trying to imply the Duchamp connection without being too overt about it, because our first typeface was Duchamp. And I thought, this is a very fitting way of sort of, you know, bookending. And yeah, it was refused. And then the second round came where there were matching funds. So our basically we say our funds would be doubled what we donated. And there was still some hesitation. I think I talked to Scott Probiak, and he's like, let me talk to Dad. And I wanted this connection to Duchamp to be very obvious. I think it says this urinal / fountain, because that's what Duchamp called his urinal. He called it the fountain, and mm-hmm. sort of this reversal thing that he was doing. So there is this plaque. But it turns out it's a waterless urinal, which kind of defeated the purpose of the fountain part. But in a way, that was even funnier, the fact that it's a waterless urinal, sort of the digital age version of Duchamp's fountain. So that exists in, I think it's the second floor men's room. I know occasionally people tell me they have seen it for the first time. And so it kind of keeps giving back, and the fact that this exists. I wanted the plaque set in the Duchamp font, but the line was drawn, and I couldn't.
Enough.
Yeah, I couldn't. I didn't have my say in that, so I think it's just using like Times New Roman or something. But at least it's not Comic Sans, right?
Speaking of, so now I'm going to ask you the funny questions. What's your favorite font?
Comic Sans, just because it gets people so mad. that's today's favorite font, but. Yeah, the favorite font is for whatever it's needed or used for, because there's no. I don't think fonts can like exist in isolation. They have to be interacted with and used. So I think, again, that changes all the time.
Yeah.
So today it's Comic Sans because of the visceral reaction it gets from people.
Recently, there was a very scientific PowerPoint presentation. That something like NASA or some serious...
Or they decided Comic Sans was the most readable font or something. But it gets people talking about why it exists. And that I think is, you know, as a design and as how it gets used, I could talk about that for hours.
At the same vein, I was very impressed, and I think we can say this publicly, that the Birchfield Penny has hired P22 to create a font.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
In the style of Charles Birchfield's writing. And when sitting in on a meeting for this font with Rich, it was phenomenal. Listening to you talk about all the different factors that go into the consideration of the creation of a font, especially one that is where the goal is for it to be as fluid as someone's handwriting. And so there's all sorts of eccentricities that you have to work into this digital font in different ways where strings of letters are rendered differently than each individual letter to make it not look so static. And I was just totally fascinated in that whole conversation.
I could use that sound clip. That was really good.
Yeah.
And we had a meeting in 2 days, I guess.
Oh, cool.
So kind of an update. One of the problems is like knowing when it's done. I think that's with any typeface too, and that's like with any artwork, knowing when to say it's done.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see if we can get this wrapped up and used. I'm curious how it survives in the world,
or how it
lives. And that's the test of it. Is like seeing it used is going
to
be great.
Yeah, well, we're very excited to have it. So, Rich, I think my final question for you is. What advice do you have for either emerging artists with an uppercase or lowercase A, creative types, makers, people who just want to make stuff?
I think just work as hard as possible at what you want to do and make it happen. And, I mean, you can kind of go crazy beating your head against the wall, but there's always a way of doing things. And I think one thing that really bothers me in the world is laziness, like intellectual laziness and physical laziness. Maybe because I find those faults in myself, I get mad at myself when I'm being lazy about something, but I realize there's a way to do whatever you want to do, and there's always an excuse to not do something. doesn't matter what it is. It's always easy to find an excuse, but doing it is usually hard work, and it's worth the effort to just keep going at it. I mean, not by any means necessary. And there's also knowing when to say when. You might say, okay, this isn't working. My photography career was derailed by the plane losing everything. Okay, well, maybe I'll shift gears a little bit. Or my school registration was canceled, so I had to take this class on bookbinding because that was the only thing that was going to keep me from collapsing and going into default on student loans and all these other like domino effects that would happen from a class of me. So I took a bookbinding class. And then so, you know, these sort of weird little things, you know, got me to sit in this chair right now. So that's kind of a persistence when it comes down to one word, with some integrity, and yeah, I'm sure a few other things, but mainly just working hard at something.
Rich, thank you so much. This has been a phenomenal interview, and I really loved having this space to talk with you about this.
Oh, shucks.
And we look forward to seeing all the future fonts that come out of P22 and your personal creative maker endeavors.
Yeah. Again, if I knew what they were going to be, I may have already done them, but I don't know. So we'll see.
You let us know when you do.
Yeah, maybe open a restaurant.